This is Audible.
Audible presents this brilliance audio production of
Peace Kills by P.J. O'Rourke. In memory of Michael Kelly. He could have advocated the war in Iraq without going to cover it. He could have covered it without putting himself in harm's way. But liberty is an expensive feast, and Mike was a man who always picked up the check. Next year we are to bring the soldiers home for lack of money, and it is all right. Places they guarded or kept orderly must guard themselves and keep themselves orderly. We want the money for ourselves at home instead of working, and this is all right. It's hard to say who wanted it to happen, but now it's been decided nobody minds. The places are a long way off, not here. Which is all right, and from what we hear, the soldiers there only made trouble happen. Next year we shall be easier in our minds. Next year we shall be living in a country that brought its soldiers home for lack of money. The statues will be standing in the same tree-muffled squares and look nearly the same. Our children will not know it's a different country. All we can hope to leave them now is money. Philip Larkin. Homage to a Government, England, 1969. 1. Why Americans Hate Foreign Policy. I was in Berlin in November 1989, the weekend the wall opened. The Cold War was over. The ICBMs weren't going to fly. The world wouldn't melt in a fusion fireball or freeze in a nuclear winter. Everybody was happy and relieved. And me, too. Although I'm not one of those children of the 1950s who was traumatized by the A-bomb, getting under a school desk during duck and cover was more interesting and less scary than the part of the multiplication table that came after time 7. Still, the notion that at any time the USSR and the USA might blow up the whole world, my neighborhood included, was in the back of my mind. A little mushroom-shaped cloud marred the sunny horizon of my future as an internationally renowned high school JV football player. If on the beach was for real, I'd never get tall enough to date Ava Gardner. What's more, whenever I was apprehended in youthful hijinks, mutually assured destruction failed to happen before Dad got home from work. Then, in the fall of 1962, when I was 15, Armageddon really did seem to arrive. I made an earnest plea to my blonde, freckled biology class lab partner, for whom, worshipfully, I had undertaken all frog dissection duties. "The Cuban Missile Crisis," I said, "means we probably won't live long. Let's do it before we die." She demurred. All in all, the Cold War was a bad thing. 27 years later, wandering through previously sinister Checkpoint Charlie with beer in hand, I felt like a weight had been lifted from my shoulders. I remember thinking just those words. I feel like a weight has been lifted. A wiser person would have been thinking, I feel like I took a big dump. Nastiness was already reaccumulating. I reported on some of it in ex-Soviet Georgia, ex-Yugoslav Yugoslavia, the West Bank, Somalia, and Iraq-ravaged Kuwait. The relatively simple, if costive process of digesting the communist bloc was complete. America needed to reconstitute its foreign policy with, so to speak, a proper balance of fruit and fiber. The serious people who ponder these things seriously said the new American foreign policy must include nation building, a different approach to national security, universal tenets of democracy. This didn't occur to me. Frankly, nothing concerning foreign policy had ever occurred to me. I had been writing about foreign countries and foreign affairs and foreigners for years. But you can own dogs all your life and not have dog policy. You have rules, yes. Get off the couch. And training, sure. We want the dumb creatures to be well-behaved and friendly. So we feed foreigners, take care of them, give them treats, and when absolutely necessary, whack them with a rolled-up newspaper. That was as far as my foreign policy thinking went until the middle 1990s, when I realized America's foreign policy thinking hadn't gone that far. In the fall of 1996, I traveled to Bosnia to visit a friend whom I'll call Major Tom. Major Tom was in Banja Luka, serving with the NATO-led International Peacekeeping Force, IFOR. From 1992 to 1995, Bosnian Serbs had fought Bosnian Croats and Bosnian Muslims in an attempt to split Bosnia into two hostile territories. In 1995, the U.S. brokered Dayton Agreement ended the war by splitting Bosnia into two hostile territories. The Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina was run by Croats and Muslims. The Republika Srpska was run by Serbs. IFOR's job was to implement and monitor the Dayton Agreement. Major Tom's job was to sit in an office where Croat and Muslim residents of Republika Srpska went to report Dayton Agreement violations. "They come to me," said Major Tom, "and they say, 'The Serbs stole my car.' And I say, 'I'm writing that in my report.' They say, 'The Serbs burned my house.' And I say, 'I'm writing that in my report.' They say, 'The Serbs raped my daughter.' And I say, 'I'm writing that in my report.' 'Then what happens?' I said. 'I put my report in a file cabinet." Major Tom had fought in the Gulf War. He'd been deployed to Haiti during the American reinstatement of President Aristide, which preceded the recent American unreinstatement. He was on his second tour of duty in Bosnia and would go on to fight in the Iraq War. That night, we got drunk. "Please, no nation building," said Major Tom. "We're the army. We kill people and break things. They didn't teach nation building in infantry school. Or in journalism school, either." The night before I left to cover the Iraq War, I got drunk with another friend who works in TV news. We were talking about how, as an approach to national security, invading Iraq was different. I'd moved my family from Washington to New Hampshire. My friend was considering getting his family out of New York. "Don't you hope," my friend said, "that all this has been thought through by someone who is smarter than we are? It is, however, a universal tenet of democracy that no one is." Americans hate foreign policy. Americans hate foreign policy because Americans hate foreigners. Americans hate foreigners because Americans are foreigners. We all come from foreign lands, even if we came 10,000 years ago on a land bridge across the Bering Strait. We didn't want anything to do with those Ice Age Siberians, them with the itchy cave bear pelt underwear and mammoth meat on their breath. We were off to the Pacific Northwest, great salmon fishing, blowout potluck dinners, a whole new life. America is not globally conscious or multicultural. Americans didn't come to America to be limey poofters, frog-eaters, bucketheads, mixed spicks, sheenies, or wogs. If we had wanted foreign entanglements, we would have stayed home. Or, in the case of those of us who were shipped to America against our will, as slaves, exiles, or transported prisoners, we would have gone back. Events in Liberia and the type of American who lives in Paris tell us what to think of that. Being foreigners ourselves, we Americans know what foreigners are up to with their foreign policy, their venomous convents, lying alliances, greedy agreements, and trick-or-treaties. America is not a wily, sneaky nation. We don't think that way. We don't think much at all, thank God. Start thinking, and pretty soon you get ideas, and then you get idealism, and the next thing you know, you've got ideology, with millions dead in concentration camps and gulags. A fundamental American question is, what's the big idea? Americans would like to ignore foreign policy. Our previous attempts at isolationism were successful. Unfortunately, they were successful for Hitler's Germany and Tojo's Japan. Evil is an outreach program. A solitary bad person sitting alone, harboring genocidal thoughts and wishing he ruled the world is not a problem unless he lives next to us in the trailer park. In the big geopolitical trailer park that is the world today, he does. America has to act. But when America acts, Other nations accuse us of being hegemonistic, of engaging in unilateralism, of behaving as if we're the only nation on earth that counts. We are. Russia used to be a superpower, but resigned to spend more time with a family. China is supposed to be mighty, but the Chinese leadership quakes when a couple of hundred Falun Gong members do Tai Chi for Jesus. The European Union looks impressive on paper, with a greater population and a larger economy than America's, but the military spending of Britain, France, Germany, and Italy combined does not equal one-third of the U.S. defense budget. The United States spends more on defense than the aforementioned countries, plus Russia, plus China, plus the next six top defense-spending nations. Any multilateral military or diplomatic effort that includes the United States is a crew team with Arnold Schwarzenegger as coxswain and Nadia Comaneci on the oars. When other countries demand a role in the exercise of global power, America can ask another fundamental American question. You and what army? Americans find foreign policy confusing. We are perplexed by the subtle tactics and complex strategies of the great game. America's great game is pulling the levers on the slot machines in Las Vegas. We can't figure out what the goal of American foreign policy is supposed to be. The goal of American tax policy is avoiding taxes. The goal of American health policy is HMO profits. The goal of American environmental policy is to clean up the environment, clearing away scruffy caribou and seals, so that America's drillers for Arctic oil don't get trampled or slapped with a flipper. But the goal of American foreign policy is to foster international cooperation, protect Americans at home and abroad, promote world peace, eliminate human rights abuses, improve U.S. business and trade opportunities, and stop global warming. We were going to stop global warming by signing the Kyoto Protocol on greenhouse gas emissions. Then we realized the Kyoto Protocol was ridiculous and unenforceable and that no one who signed it was even trying to meet the emissions requirements, except for some countries from the former Soviet Union. They accidentally quit emitting greenhouse gases because their economies collapsed. However, if we withdraw from diplomatic agreements because they're ridiculous, we'll have to withdraw from every diplomatic agreement because they're all ridiculous. This will not foster international cooperation. But if we do foster international cooperation, we won't be able to protect Americans at home and abroad because there has been a lot of international cooperation in killing Americans. Attacking internationals won't promote world peace, which we can't have anyway if we're going to eliminate human rights abuses, because there's no peaceful way to get rid of the governments that abuse the rights of people. People who are chained to American gym shoe-making machinery, dying of gym shoe lung, and getting paid in shoelaces, thereby improving U.S. business and trade opportunities, which result in economic expansion that causes global warming to get worse. As the 19th century American naval hero Stephen Decatur said in his famous toast, "Our country, in her intercourse with foreign nations, may she always be in the right, but our country, right or wrong, should carry condoms in her purse." One problem with changing America's foreign policy is that we keep doing it. After the Cold War, President George H.W. Bush managed to engage America, in spite of itself, in the multilateralism of the Gulf War. This left Saddam Hussein exactly where we found him 12 years later. Like other American achievements in multilateralism, it wasn't something we'd care to achieve again. The east side of Midtown Manhattan, where a decent slum once stood, is blighted by the United Nations headquarters. And in the mountains of the Balkan Peninsula, the ghost of Woodrow Wilson wanders Marley-like, dragging his chains and regretting the deeds of his life. President Bill Clinton dreamed of letting the lion lie down with the lamb chop. Clinton kept International Monetary Fund cash flowing into the ever-criminalizing Russian economy. He ignored Kremlin misbehavior, from Boris Yeltsin's shelling of elected representatives in the Duma to Vladimir Putin's airlifting uninvited Russian troops into Kosovo. Clinton compared the Chechnya fighting to the American Civil War. murdered Chechens being on the South Carolina State House Confederate flag-flying side. Clinton called China America's strategic partner and paid a 9-day visit to that country, not bothering himself with courtesy calls on America's actual strategic partners, Japan and South Korea. Clinton announced, "We don't support independence for Taiwan," and said of Jiang Zemin, instigator of the assault on democracy protesters in Tiananmen Square, "He has vision." Anything for peace. That was Clinton's policy. Clinton had special peace-mongering envoys in Cyprus, Congo, the Middle East, the Balkans, and flying off to attend secret talks with Marxist guerrillas in Colombia. Clinton made frantic attempts to close an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. What if the Jews controlled the Temple Mount and the Arabs controlled the movie industry? On his last day in office, Clinton was still phoning Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. "Love your work, Gerry. Do you ever actually kill people, or do you just do the spin?" Clinton was everybody's best friend, except when he wasn't. He conducted undeclared air wars against Serbia and Iraq and launched missiles at Sudan and Afghanistan. Clinton used the military more often than any previous peacetime American president. He sent armed forces into areas of conflict on an average of once every 9 weeks. Then we elected an administration with adults in it. Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. Gone was the harum-scarum Clinton policy-making apparatus with its frenzied bakeheads piling up midnight pizza boxes in the old executive office building. They disappeared, along with the clinically insane confidants, vein-popping James Carville, toe-sucking Dick Morris, and the loose haircuts in the West Wing and the furious Harrington on the White House third floor. President George W. Bush's foreign policy was characterized in early 2001 as disciplined and consistent, Condoleezza Rice, blunt, The Washington Post, and in your face, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Bush began his term with the expulsion of one-fourth of the Russian diplomatic corps on grounds of espionage. He snubbed Vladimir Putin by delaying a first summit meeting until June 2001 and then holding it in fashionable Slovenia. On April 1, 2001, a Chinese fighter jet, harassing a U.S. reconnaissance plane in international airspace, collided with the American aircraft, which was forced to land in Chinese territory. Bush did not regard this as an April Fool's prank. By the end of the month, he had gone on Good Morning America and said that if China attacked Taiwan, the United States had an obligation to defend it. "With the full force of American military?" asked Charlie Gibson. "Whatever it took," said Bush. The president also brandished American missile defenses at Russia and China. The Russians and Chinese were wroth. The missile shield might or might not stop missiles, but even unbuilt, it was an effective tool for gathering intelligence on Russian and Chinese foreign policy intentions. We knew how things stood when the town drunk and the town bully strongly suggested that we shouldn't get a new home security system. In the Middle East, Bush made an attempt to let the Israelis and the Palestinians go at it until David ran out of pebbles and Goliath had been hit on the head so many times that he was voting for Likud. In Northern Ireland, Bush also tried minding his own business, and Bush quit negotiating with North Korea about its atomic weapons for the same reason that you'd quit jawing with a crazy person about the gun he was waving and call 911. We saw the results of Clinton's emotional ad hoc higgledy-piggledy foreign policy. It led to strained relations with Russia and China, increased violence in the Middle East, continued fighting in Africa and Asia, and Serbs killing Albanians. Then we saw the results of Bush's tough, calculated, focused foreign policy. Strained relations with Russia and China, increased violence in the Middle East, continued fighting in Africa and Asia, and Albanians killing Serbs. Between the first year of the Clinton administration and the first year of the Bush administration, we went from attack on the World Trade Center to World Trade Center attack. Further changes could be made to U.S. foreign policy. For a sample of alternative ideas, we can turn to a group of randomly, even haphazardly, chosen average, not to say dull normal, Americans, the 2004 Democratic presidential hopefuls. By the time this is read, most of them will be forgotten. With luck, all of them will be. Nonetheless, it's instructive to recall what 10 people who offered themselves as potential leaders of the world deemed to be America's foreign policy options. Incessant activist Al Sharpton pleaded for a policy of befriending and creating allies around the world. The way Sharpton intended to make friends was by fixing the world's toilets and sinks. There are 1.7 billion people that need clean water, he said. Almost 3 billion that need sanitation systems. I would train engineers, would export people that would help with these things. Ex-child mayor of Cleveland, Dennis Kucinich, promised to establish a cabinet-level Department of Peace. The Secretary of Peace would do for international understanding what the Postmaster General does for mail. Former one-term senator and erstwhile ambassador to New Zealand, Carol Moseley Brown, said, I believe women have a contribution to make. We are clever enough to defeat terror without destroying our own liberty. We can provide for long-term security by making peace everybody's business. Elect me because women are clever busybodies. This is the Lucy and Ethel get an idea foreign policy. Massachusetts' thinner, more sober senator, John Kerry, said that he voted for threatening to use force on Saddam Hussein, but that actually using force was wrong. This is what's known in the language of diplomacy as bullshit. Previous, almost Vice President Joe Lieberman indignantly demanded that Bush do somewhat more of what Bush already was doing. Commit more U.S. troops, create an Iraqi interim authority, and work with the Iraqi people and the United Nations. Perhaps Lieberman hadn't gotten over coming this close to the office next to the Oval One. Perhaps Lieberman was suffering from a delusion that he was part of the current presidential administration. But after 9/11, Americans wanted to kiss the Supreme Court. Imagine having a Democrat as commander-in-chief during the war against terrorism, with Oprah Winfrey as Secretary of Defense. Big hug for Mr. Taliban. Republicans are squares, but it's the squares who know how to fly the bombers, launch the missiles, and fire the M-16s. Democrats would still be fumbling with the federally mandated trigger locks. And did Al Gore grow that beard for a while, just in case the Taliban won? One-time governor of insignificant Vermont, Howard Dean, wanted a Cold War on terrorism. Dean said that we had won the Cold War without firing a shot, a statement that doubtless surprised veterans of Korea and Vietnam. Dean said that the reason we had won the Cold War without firing a shot was because we were able to show the communists a better ideal. But what is the better ideal that we can show the Islamic fundamentalists? Maybe we can tell them, our president is a born again. You're religious lunatics. We're religious lunatics. America was founded by religious lunatics. How about those Salem witch trials? Come to America and you could be Osama bin Ashcroft. You could get your own state like Utah, run by religious lunatics. You could have an Islamic fundamentalist Winter Olympics, the Chador Shush. Since the gist of Howard Dean's campaign platform was, it worked in Vermont, he really may have thought that the terrorists should take up snowboarding. On the other hand, the gist of General, very retired, Wesley Clark's campaign platform was, it worked in Kosovo. Kosovo certainly taught the world a lesson. Wherever there's suffering, injustice, and oppression, America will show up 6 months late and bomb the country next to where it's happening. The winner of South Carolina's JFK look-alike contest, John Edwards, and the winner of Florida's Phil Gramm look-alike contest, Phil Gramm, said that America had won the war in Iraq but was losing the peace because Iraq was so unstable. When Iraq was stable, it attacked Israel in 1967 and 1973. It attacked Iran. It attacked Kuwait. It gassed the Kurds. It butchered the Shiites. It fostered terrorism in the Middle East. Who wanted a stable Iraq? And perennial representative of the House of Representatives, Dick Gephardt, wouldn't talk much about foreign policy. He was concentrating on economic issues, claiming that he'd make the American dream come true for everyone. Gephardt may have been onto something there. Once people get rich, they don't go in much for war making. The shoes are ugly and the uniforms itch. Someday, Osama bin Laden will call a member of one of his sleeper cells, a person who was planted in the United States years before and told to live like a normal American, and... Dad, some guy named Ozzy's on the phone? Good to hear from you. Of course. Rockefeller Center. Next Wednesday. Well, I'd love to, but the kid's got her ballet recital. You miss something like that, they'll never forget it. Thursday's no good. I have to see my mom off on her cruise to Bermuda in the morning. It's Fatima's yoga day, and I've got courtside seats for the Nets. Friday, we're going to the Hamptons for the weekend. But how exactly did Gephardt plan to make everyone on Earth as materialistic, self-indulgent, and overscheduled as Americans? Would Gephardt give foreigners options on hot dot-com stocks? That might have worked during the Clinton years. As of early 2004, there was one foremost pressing question in U.S. foreign policy, and America didn't seem to have the answers for post-war Iraq. Then again, what were the questions? Was there a bad man and his bad kids? Were they running a bad country that did bad things? Did they have a lot of oil money to do bad things with? Were they going to do more bad things? If those were the questions, was the answer UN-supervised national reconciliation or rapid return to self-rule? Nah. The answer was, blow the place to bits. Critics say we didn't do enough thinking about the problem of post-war Iraq. I say we blew the place to bits. What's the problem? If there is something we didn't do enough thinking about, something we haven't done enough thinking about for 15 years, it's fascism. The genius of fascism is to turn people into a mob. Ba'ath Party fascism did a good job. Fascism doesn't use only the stick. It uses the carrot as well, albeit in a brutal fashion. There's a lot of being hit over the head with root vegetables involved in fascism. But Hitler would have ended up painting carnival sideshow posters in Bavaria if a mob of Germans hadn't thought they were getting something out of fascism. And how do you plan for a mob? Do you buy the Martha Stewart book of gracious rioting? Americans have been surprised by Iraqi fascism, although we are familiar enough with other evil ideologies. Communism still persists in Cuba, North Korea, and the minds of a million university-type intellectuals. Religious extremism waxes worldwide, but communists do bad things for a purpose. They have a vision of a utopia where everyone shares everything, and you give your lawn boy to a family in Chad. And religious extremists do bad things for a purpose. They have a vision of a utopia where everyone goes to heaven together. So what if you have to die to get there? You have to die to get to heaven anyway. Fascism, however, is a pointless ideology. The grasp of power for power's sake. The fight against fascism seems like dad's war. Granddad's war. Fascism should be out of date in the purposeful, task-oriented world of today. Never mind Slobodan Milosevic, Vladimir Putin, Yasser Arafat, Somali warlords, Charles Taylor, China's Politburo, the Saudi royal family, murderous Hutu rabble, and Newt Gingrich's career arc. Fascists do bad things just to be bad. I'm the baddest dude in Baghdad, Saddam Hussein was saying. The baddest cat in the Middle East. I'm way bad. This was way stupid. But fascists are stupid. Consider Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. He didn't have any. How stupid does that make Saddam? All he had to do was say to UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix, look where you want. Look beneath the couch cushions. Look under my bed. Look in the special spider hole I'm keeping for emergencies. And Saddam Hussein could have gone on dictatoring away until Donald Rumsfeld is elected head of the World Council of Churches. Instead, we blew the place to bits, and a mess was left behind. But it's a mess without a military to fight aggressive wars. A mess without the facilities to develop dangerous weapons. A mess that cannot systematically kill, torture, and oppress millions of its citizens. It's a mess with a message. Don't mess with us. Saddam Hussein was reduced to the Unabomber. Ted Kaczynski, a nutcase hiding in the sticks. The terrorism his cohorts practice is terrifying, hence its name. Killing innocent people by surprise is not called a thousand points of light. But as frightening as terrorism is, it's the weapon of losers. When someone detonates a suicide bomb, that person does not have career prospects. And no matter how horrific the terrorist attack, it's conducted by losers. Winners don't need to hijack airplanes. Winners have an air force. 2. Kosovo, November 1999. America is the winner in the new era of highly moral conflicts. Just wars. Good wars. Wars to end other wars. I covered a couple of these, in Kuwait in 1991 and Somalia in 1993. But I didn't stick around for the aftermaths, and it will be remembered, especially by Iraqi Shiites of the Basra region, neither did America. It wasn't until the NATO occupation of Kosovo that I got a chance to see what happens when the ancient tradition of invasion is stood on its ear. Contrary to a million years of human instincts, conquest now entails giving rather than taking territory while exploiting the victim's labor and resources to heap booty on the conquered. The air war against Yugoslavia had been declared a victory. Kosovo was being run by the UN, NATO, and other forces for good. Forces for good, and plenty of them. Here are some of the more than 300 well-meaning organizations that were active in Kosovo at the end of 1999. Humanity First, Emergency Corps of the Order of Malta, Center for Mind-Body Medicine, Associazione Amici dei Bambini, Mother Teresa Society, Saudi Joint Relief Committee, American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, Iranian Relief Committee, Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, and the World Society for Protection of Animals. So, could Serbs and Albanians now live together peacefully? A young Albanian and former Kosovo Liberation Army fighter said yes. Well, what he actually said was, "When you hate this much, maybe you would kill them all, but we will try to live with them," which shows what kind of people we are. Something else that showed what kind of people they are was the NATO brand bubblegum for sale locally, with bubblegum cards depicting victims of Serb atrocities, KLA martyrs, Albanian refugees, and a cruise missile direct hit on Serbian police headquarters in Pristina. But the KLA veteran did not look like someone who had been chewing over blood vengeance since his first Halloween. He looked like a slightly bored, faintly irritated member of a tenant committee, which he was, except that the committee was petitioning the Norwegian army instead of a landlord. "A sewer line is blocked," said the tenant committee chairwoman. "Heating oil supply is low. We need more garbage containers." "We will not have everything for everyone," said a beleaguered Norwegian infantry captain. The captain was in Kosovo Polja, site of the Battle of Kosovo, where the Ottoman Turks threw the Serbs out of Kosovo in the first place in 1389. Now, Albanian Kosovars had done it again, this time by squatting rather than fighting, in a housing complex that used to be 80% Serb and had become 80% Albanian. The Norwegians were on hand to prevent murder and also to provide more garbage containers. "The level of hatred will always exist," said the KLA veteran, "but we are a peaceful nation and we will try to live with them, if the people who did bad things are punished." "Thank you for controlling the youths who were throwing stones," said the Norwegian captain. "We try," said the chairwoman. Battle-hardened combatants beating their swords into complaints about water pressure and their spears into requests to fix the electrical wiring, it was a dream conflict for liberals, a peace on earth, goodwill to men, Kris Kringle of a military action. Kosovo was the war haters loved. Bianca Jagger, Susan Sontag, Barney Frank, House Democratic Whip David Bonier, the late Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone, and various other usually reliable advocates of peace seemed to have been drinking at the VFW hall and getting Semper Fi tattooed on their biceps. "I harbor no second thoughts on the morality of our course," Senator Wellstone said. "My only regret is that our action has been less effective than I would have hoped." Such a regret, of course, depends upon what was hoped for. If we hoped to increase wartime destruction, we were very effective. Normally, the victor in a war does most of the damage, but in Kosovo, everybody got to destroy things. Losers, winners, and neutral nations alike. The locals explained how to tell the difference between the piles of rubble. When the destruction was general, it was Serbian. Serbs surrounded Albanian villages and shelled them. When the destruction was specific, it was Albanian. Albanians set fire to Serb homes and businesses. And when the destruction was pointless, involving a bridge to nowhere, an empty oil storage tank, an evacuated Serb police headquarters and the like, it was NATO trying to fight a war without hurting anybody. However, if we hoped to protect ethnic Albanians, we were, as Senator Wellstone mentioned, less effective. In fact, we were less effective at protecting ethnic Albanians than Slobodan Milosevic had been. According to the U.S. State Department, an estimated 10,000 Albanians were killed and 1.5 million were expelled from their homes, most of them after the NATO air war began. On the road from Pec to Istok, in the hills of northwest Kosovo, every single building had been destroyed. Beside the highway, in a gravel patch leveled by a bulldozer, were the graves of 19 members of the Imaraj family, men, women, and children. The tombs were covered by a type of floral arrangement particular to Kosovo. This is a thin, yard-wide disc of foliage with brightly colored blossoms sprinkled on the green background, and the whole wrapped tightly in cellophane. Muslim Albanians naturally have no Yuletide decorating tradition and wouldn't understand the horrible free association caused in an American mind. And to all a good night by these mementos of the Santa War, these giant Christmas cookies of death. We failed to protect Albanians from Serbs, but we were making up for it by protecting Serbs from Albanians, even though it was Serb persecution of Albanians that caused us to come to Kosovo, thereby giving Albanians an opportunity to persecute Serbs. In a background briefing, a British colonel said, "Out of a pre-war Serbian population of 30,000, there are 875 Serbs left in Pristina." "Exactly 875?" I asked. "Exactly." And more visions of St. Nick as NATO's Supreme Allied Commander, Europe. "The colonel knew when the Serbs were sleeping. He knew when they were awake." He had 250 of his men living with the Serbs. "Living with them? And doing what?" I asked. "Keeping them alive." "Sometimes." On November 29th, 1999, three elderly Serbs were pulled from their car in central Pristina. The man was killed. The two women were severely beaten. On October 11th, 1999, an Albanian passerby asked a Bulgarian UN worker in Serbian, "What time is it?" The Bulgarian replied in Bulgarian, a language too similar to Serbian. He was shot to death. But the forces for good were agreed that Serbs should stay in Kosovo. And so were the forces for bad. Milosevic wanted Serbs in Kosovo so he could claim that Kosovo was still part of Serbia. NATO wanted Serbs in Kosovo because when you're fighting a war to save lives, you gotta save somebody's. The UN definitely wanted Serbs in Kosovo. If you don't like multiculturalism, why have a UN? And Senator Paul Wellstone wanted Serbs in Kosovo to show how wonderful multiculturalism can be if you've got 42,000 troops to enforce it. Six of those troops were bivouacked in an apartment in downtown Pristina to safeguard 24-year-old Maria, two floors up, the last remaining Serb in the building. This was not bad duty. Maria was beautiful, and her mother, visiting from exile in Serbia, was cute too. It would be a hard test in bigotry for a normal man to hate this pair. Some of the local fellows managed to pass. "What time is it?" they asked Maria on the street. I asked Maria, "How do you see your future in Kosovo?" "I don't see it at all," she said. "I just sold my flat. I'm moving to Belgrade." "Is there any future for Serbs in Kosovo?" "No." In perfect agreement with Maria was the KLA commander of the LAP region of northeast Kosovo, Major General Mustafa Remy. That is, Remy would have been a Major General, except that the KLA was demilitarized and had been disarmed. There hasn't been a disarmament, said General, or whatever, Remy, who was wearing a pistol and being saluted by Albanians. We have only stored our weapons. I brought up the subject of UN Resolution 1244. This is the piece of paper that set NATO upon the Serbs. The resolution states, with an interesting choice of verb, that Kosovo can enjoy substantial autonomy within the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. Does the KLA, I asked the general, still aspire to an independent Kosovo? We don't aspire, said Remy, doing his best, which was very good, to look scary. We see an independent Kosovo as a reality. What if the Western nations don't support this? Remy's logic was sound. I think we are having their support, considering the support that they are offering us. At Camp Bondsteel, the U.S. headquarters in Kosovo, I interviewed a more affable officer. Camp Bondsteel was an 800-acre fortified compound in southern Kosovo, housing 3,500 U.S. soldiers atop a ridge that dominated 100 square miles of rolling farmland. At night, Bondsteel was lit the way the city on the Hill of the Gospels would have been lit if they had had diesel generators in St. Matthew's time. By day, the earthen tracks and paths were being turned into gravel roads. The tents were being replaced with wooden barracks. The only sewage treatment plant in Kosovo had been built. I think the conflict is not over yet, General Remy had told me. The American officer said, we learned a lesson in Bosnia. Tents only last 3 winters. I asked the officer, can you really turn this place into a multicultural society? We'll try our best. After all, said the officer with an optimistic, very American smile, if anybody can do it, we can. Which, back in America, we, rather famously, can't. A bored black private stood guard at another American fortress, Camp Monteith, in southeastern Kosovo. On the subject of local hatreds, he said, at least if they put you and me in a police lineup, they can tell us apart. But they can tell Maria, too. Serbs are identifiable, said Maria. I can't explain why. It's subtle. Facial structure. She told me about a 10-year-old boy walking down the street who pulled a knife on her and said, you are Serb. I kill you. Maria's mother said a little kid ran up to her and pantomimed a throat slitting. Maybe it's the bubblegum. Or maybe it's history. Peoples who hate each other often seem to be fond of history. The Serbs say, have always been in Kosovo, except that the Serbs didn't arrive in the Balkans until the 6th century A.D. So Albanians, the Albanians say, have always been in Kosovo. Although British historian Miranda Vickers says, Serbian archaeologists have been hard at work seeking to refute the long-standing Albanian claim for a continuity of descent from the ancient Illyrians. Anyway, somebody's always been in Kosovo. And somebody else is always showing up, the way the Ottoman Turks did in 1389. The Battle of Kosovo caused a large portion of Kosovo's Serbs to leave for, among other places, Transylvania, making one wonder why the Serbs don't hate vampires rather than ethnic Albanians. The Serbs reconquered Kosovo in 1912 and committed atrocities against the Albanians, who sided with Germany in 1914 and oppressed the Serbs, who regained control of Kosovo in 1918 and tyrannized the Albanians, who sided with the Germans again in 1939 and crushed the Serbs, who recaptured Kosovo in 1945 and persecuted the Albanians, who rioted in 1981 and beat and robbed the Serbs, who... Oh, said Maria's mother to Maria with an I-forgot-to-feed-the-cat look. You got another threatening phone call. A man's voice said, what are you waiting for? Food aid was the answer to that question in Grozdevac, a Serb village in western Kosovo that once had a population of 2,000. The number of residents shrank to about 30 during the air war, but had now returned to 800, said the village drunk, although 770 seemed to be making themselves scarce. The village headman, or anyway the oldest male around, explained that it took 5 soldiers from the Italian Armored Brigade in Peck to escort a single villager into the fields. As a result, no winter wheat had been planted, there wasn't enough livestock fodder to last until spring, and, he grew grave, yesterday a haystack was set on fire. How are people living? I asked.
Food aid, he said, serving the Italian soldiers, a son-in-law, me, and the village drunk morning glasses of Slivovica Monastirka that, if you missed your mouth, could provide a skin peel and an eyelid tuck.
Can Serbs and Albanians live together peacefully? I asked.
We would like to live as before the war, said the headman. Even though in the past we didn't want to live together, we lived together.
There is only one God above us, said the village drunk.
I asked if the Milosevic government had been unfair to the Albanians. The headman's son-in-law answered.
Milosevic called for Albanians and Serbs to live together.
2 little boys peeked shyly at the yakking men. The son-in-law said he had named them Wolf and Fearless.
The Albanians would start a war anyway, said the son-in-law.
The village was a Peter Bruegel painting. If you ignored the villagers in Nikes and the corrugated metal and concrete block that augmented the thatch and the wattle and daub, a listing half-timbered grist mill sat athwart a stream. The stream wandered through the main road, and so did pigs. The cultural level of Albanians is low. Serbian culture is more high, said the son-in-law. Luan Mulekaj, the new Albanian director of Kosovo's National Galleria e Artive, which was up and running in Pristina, although things like water and electricity often weren't, said, "What is a difficult place to live is, for culture, heaven." Mulekaj was giving me a tour, partly by flashlight, of an exhibit of Kosovar Albanian modern art. Intimations of dread and portraits of corpses pervaded the pictures, although most were painted a quarter of a century before, when Yugoslavia was supposedly a multicultural model to the world. Even the abstracts looked worried. One of these was gloomy and terrifying, without anything on the canvas except a white, billowing shape.
A shroud, said Mulekaj.
The recent artworks, created during the previous year's chaos, were more cheerful. Mulekaj, himself a sculptor, was finishing a piece that incorporated a swatch of the green astroturf of hope, an array of the tools of reconstruction, and some new wood rafters fastened to an old charred roof beam. A corpse was hanging from those rafters, but it was a cheerful sculpture, comparatively speaking. Serbs argued that Kosovo's Albanians were cheerful because they were enjoying their martyrdom. An Albanian with 7 sons will sacrifice 6 for Albanian independence, said the village drunk in Garajdevac, perhaps making poor young Wolf and Fearless think, don't give Dad ideas. More likely, what Kosovo's Albanians were enjoying was a chance to provide martyrdom to Serbs, especially their immediate neighbors. Crimes in Kosovo were done by Serbs here, said the KLA vet in Kosovo Polje. No Serb in Belgrade would know which house Albanians lived in. In Pazjane, another of Kosovo's Serb villages, the school principal begged to differ, at least about the behavior of the Serbs in his hometown. There was no killing, he said. There was no looting. He paused. A large photograph of Slobodan Milosevic hung on his office wall. Well, maybe there was some. But all the dirty people ran away to Serbia. The people remaining in Pasjane are all honest, decent people. Honest, decent, and furious. Pasjane, in the far southeast of Kosovo, was under intermittent mortar attack from Albanians in the surrounding hills who hadn't gotten the news about storing their weapons. A man had been killed 2 days before. The other men in Pasjane left the funeral and gathered in the churchyard. They pointed to gravestones damaged by mortar attacks. They pointed to the shrapnel scars on the church. This church is from the 1200s. This village is from 1340. First to fight the Turks. Before 1389, all these villages were Serb. Old hatreds aside, new hatreds were growing apace. Hatred for the Americans guarding Pasjane, for example.
A U.S. Army forensics team had come to gather the shell fragments from the lethal mortar attack. The Pasiane Serbs said that they believed the U.S. Army did this to hide something. When the man was killed, they said, an American armored personnel carrier was down the road. The APC turned off its engine just before the mortar shell struck. The Pasiane Serbs thought the U.S. Army was giving a signal to hidden Albanians. Why couldn't everyone cooperate in Kosovo the way Russian troops and NATO troops were cooperating, which, according to official military sources with whom I spoke, was fully, even if the Russians had arrived as peacekeeping gate crashers, and even if the Russians were supposed to be perpetrating in Chechnya what the Russians were supposed to be preventing in Kosovo, and even if, as one Norwegian enlisted man said unofficially, the Russians drink on duty? Time is the best medicine, said a colonel in the Russian Medical Corps who was running a civilian clinic in Kosovo, Polje. If time is the best medicine, I said, why don't we all feel better than we did 20 years ago? That, the colonel said, is a good question. Another good question was, what really should be done with the Serbs and Albanians? One British soldier, on night patrol through a former Serbian, now sooty ruin, section of Pristina, said, it's what barbed wire was invented for. But advocating barbed wire would have embarrassed the forces for good, the participants in the peace blitzkrieg, the elves in the Santa War. So the tenant committee meetings went on. We'd like you to take down the Albanian flag on the balcony, said the beleaguered Norwegian captain in Kosovo, Polje. It could be seen as a provocation. It's a wedding tradition, said the chairwoman. The wedding was last week. Flying the flag from Thursday to Monday, that is the tradition, said the KLA veteran. Well, tomorrow is Tuesday, said the captain. And one more thing. There are too many stray dogs. They're creating a health problem. Said an Italian colonel in Peck, this is the future of war. 3. Israel, April 2001. Passover is my idea of a perfect holiday. Dear God, when you're handing out plagues of darkness, locusts, hail, boils, flies, lice, frogs, and cattle murrin, and turning the Nile to blood, and smiting firstborn, give me a pass and tell me when it's over. And the Lord did well by me at Passover. Brilliant sunshine on the beaches of Tel Aviv, pellucid waters, no flies in my room at the Hilton, and certainly no lice. I am a firstborn myself, but was not the least smitten, not even by the cute waitress at the Hilton's kosher sushi restaurant. I am a happily married man. And by the way, Leviticus 11:10 says, of any living thing which is in the waters, they shall be an abomination unto you. An apt description of sushi as far as I'm concerned. But Gentiles aren't expected to understand the intricacies of dietary law, although extra complications thereof lead to Passover's main drawback, food and, more important to Gentiles, drink. I'll have a scotch, I said to the Hilton's bartender. Scotch isn't kosher for Passover, he said. It's made with leaven. Gin and tonic. Gin isn't kosher. What can I have? You can have a screwdriver, Israeli vodka and orange juice. What's Israeli vodka like? The orange juice is very good. There was no plague of tourists in Israel. It should have been a period of hectic visitation, with Passover beginning April 7th and the Eastern Orthodox and Western Easters coinciding a week later. But Israel's income from tourism dropped 58% in the last quarter of 2000, and to judge by the lineless queues at Ben-Gurion Airport and the empty-seated aisles of Al Al, the drop had continued. The marble lobby of the Hilton echoed, when at all, with the chatter of idle desk clerks and bellhops. The din of strife had rendered Israel quiet. Quiet without portentous hush. Traffic hum, AC buzz, and cell phone beepings indicated ordinary life in an ordinary place. Tourism wasn't the only thing there was no sign of in Israel. Demonstrations didn't block intersections. Public address systems failed to crackle with imperatives, Exigent posters weren't stuck to walls except to advertise raves. There was no sign of crisis, international or bilateral or domestic political, although all news reports agreed that a crisis raged here, and an economic crisis as well. A 12% quarterly decline in gross domestic product was unevident in boarded-up shops and empty cafes, which didn't exist, or in beggars and homeless, who weren't on the streets. There was no sign of terrorism, not that there hadn't been some, but what doesn't inspire terror, by definition, isn't terrorism. The Carmel market was crowded, either with people wholly unafraid or with people indifferent to whether they were blown up singly or in bunches. If security was pervasive, it was invisible. Israel, I've heard, is hated fanatically by millions of Muslims around the world, whereas the U.S. Congress is loathed only by a small number of well-informed people who follow politics closely. But a walk around anything in Israel is less impeded by barriers and armed guards than a walk around the Capitol building in Washington. There was no sign of war. Plenty of soldiers were to be seen, carrying their weapons, but this is no shock to the frequent traveler. For all that the world looks askance at America's lack of gun control, foreigners love to wave guns around. Nothing about the Israeli Defense Forces is as odd as Italian carabinieri brandishing their machine pistols while grimly patrolling that flashpoint, Venice. There was, in fact, no sign of anything in Tel Aviv. In particular, there was no sign of Israel's vital importance to world peace, except, of course, those signs of vital importance to world peace that one sees everywhere, the lettering here in Hebrew, but the trademark logos recognizable enough. Tel Aviv is new, built on the sand dunes north of Jaffa in the 1890s, about the same time Miami was founded. The cities bear a resemblance in size, site, climate, and architecture, ranging from the bland to the fancifully bland. In Miami, the striving, somewhat troublesome immigrant population is the result of Russia's meddling with Cuba. In Tel Aviv, the striving, somewhat troublesome immigrant population is the result of Russia's meddling with itself. I found a Russian restaurant where they couldn't have cared less what was made with leaven, where they had scotch, and where, over one scotch too many, I contemplated the absurdity of Israel being an ordinary place. What if people who had been away for ages, out and on their own, suddenly showed up at their old home and demanded to move back in? My friends with grown-up children tell me this happens all the time. What if the countless ancient tribal groups that are now defeated, dispersed and stateless, contrived to reestablish themselves in their ancestral lands in such a way as to dominate everyone around them? The Mashantucket Pequots are doing so this minute at their Foxwoods Casino in southeastern Connecticut. What if a religious group sought a homeland, never minding how multifarious its religion had become or how divergent its adherents were in principles and practices? A homeland for Protestants would have to satisfy the aspirations of born-again literalists holding forth about creationism in their concrete block tabernacles and also fulfill the hopes and dreams of vaguely churched latitudinarians giving praise to God's creation by playing golf on Sundays. A Protestant Zion would need to be perfect both for sniping at abortion doctors in North Carolina and for marrying lesbians in Vermont. As an American, I already live in that country. Maybe there's nothing absurd about Israel. I wandered out into the ordinary nighttime down Jabotinsky Street, named after the founder of revisionist Zionism, Zev Jabotinsky, who wrote in 1923, "A voluntary agreement between us and the Arabs of Palestine is inconceivable now or in the foreseeable future." Thus, Jabotinsky broke with the father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, who in Altneuland, 1902, had a fictional future Arab character in a fictional future Israel saying, "The Jews have made us prosperous. Why should we be angry with them?" And now the Carmel market was full of goods from Egypt. From Jabotinsky Street, I meandered into Weizmann Street, named for the first president of Israel, Chaim Weizmann, who in 1919 met with Emir Faisal, future king of Iraq, and a son of the Sharif of Mecca, and concluded an agreement that all necessary measures shall be taken to encourage and stimulate immigration of Jews into Palestine on a large scale. Faisal sent a letter to the American Zionist delegates at the Versailles Peace Conference wishing Jews a most hearty welcome home. Turning